coming through from UK universities and UK companies, absolutely world class. And yeah. I think we can just bring everybody together, which is, you know, where advanced engineering comes along, as you said, then honestly, there's no reason why the UK wouldn't rule the world, seriously.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Advanced Engineering Talks, a podcast created by the Advanced Engineering team. A Talks brings together some of the newest and most innovative minds in engineering and manufacturing to help better the future for our industry. We hope you enjoy the series.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to another edition of our Advanced Engineering Talks podcast, where innovation never sleeps. I am delighted to be joined today by a real supporter of the Advanced Engineering event, but also very key industry player, Dr. Alan Banks. Alan is, of course, UK Lightweight Innovations Manager at Ford Motor Company and Chair of the Board of Directors for Composites UK. Alan, it's great to see you.
It's lovely to see you.
Yeah, thank you for joining me. In fact, we've recently hosted together. You were kind enough to co-host a great cast with Richard Noble, OBE, who we're just editing that down at the moment and should be planning to get that out for our September edition. But that was a really great conversation, I think really enjoyable. You, of course, are obviously a real expert in lightweighting composite materials, and vitally, of course, you're hugely involved in issues surrounding sustainability, which is something I hope we might touch on and is a watchword of the Advanced Engineering event this year, actually. Actually, an interesting thing, Alan, that I just noticed recently about you, which you also have a lovely honour on your LinkedIn, which is Liveryman of the Worshipful Company of Engineers, which sounds a wonderful traditional kind of honour. What does that involve? Because it sounds quite one of those old established traditional honours.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. The Worshipful Company of Engineers are one of a number of liveried organisations throughout the City of London.
Right.
And we are kind of pushing and promoting the engineering profession as pretty much the role of the Worshipful Company. We've been chartered, we've had a royal charter since 2003. So sort of 20 years now. I think we were formed in 1983. We've been going for quite a long time. To be a liveryman, you must first be a freeman of the City of London. So I can drive sheep over London Bridge.
My next question. Have you tried doing that yet? I've yet to see anyone doing that.
Yeah, last year I was on holiday when the sheep drive was on, and this year I think I've got another engagement that aligns with it as well. So I'm not doing very well on the driving sheep bit, but I'm hoping to do it soon. I've heard it's a really, really fun event. But we're involved with a charitable side of the organisation. You know, we attend the Lord Mayor's show. We have a little stall on that goes along the pageant for the Lord Mayor's show and things like that, and we get involved the Lord Mayor and the sheriffs. I've only been involved recently in the Worshipful Company of Engineers, but it's something that I really want to cultivate, because, you know, as I said, this is an organisation whose sole remit, if you like, is to promote engineering, and it's got a lot of interesting and really well-connected people within the organisation. So it's something that I'm very keen to start working with as my familiarity with the organisation becomes fuller.
Well, that's really interesting. And also, I mean, that almost brings me to a question I was going to ask a bit later on, but I think it's interesting to ask now, pertinent, because you are passionate about education in terms of, you know, engineering. We know we've got a skills gap. We know that many of our schools and really at the youngest levels, you know, ideally need to get more involved in STEM and those subject areas. You are, in fact, I think, a STEM ambassador as well, aren't you?
And, I am indeed. Yeah.
And what does that involve for you, Alan?
So I get contacted by the Southeast STEM organisation, and that we are asked to go into schools to either do they actually call it speed dating, but it's more like a speed careers event. So it is almost like speed dating, if you like. You go to a table. Not that I would know. I'd like to point that out. But it's you go around the table and you have kind of 5 minutes to do a little presentation and convince the kids that engineering is something, you know, that is something that should interest them. Then the whistle blows and then everybody moves around and then you start it all again. And that goes on for about an hour. And I just find it a really, really good event because you can get around to a lot of kids, all in the one place. And we also do a lot of career evenings, you know, where we're obviously promoting the automotive industry, which is, you know, where my passion really lies, but also the advanced engineering side as well, because I just think that, I mean, as you said, I'm very passionate about the STEM bit and the education side of it completely. We're at a crossroads in the engineering organization, and we have, honestly, a golden opportunity to promote the engineering to within our younger, and I'm going to call them colleagues, because they're going to be our colleagues.
100%, yeah.
We have the most socially aware demographic that we've probably ever had when it comes to sustainability, recyclability, and making sure that we look after the planet. And if we as engineers can't convince our younger colleagues that this is a profession that should really, you know, sort of motivate them, then really we're missing a trick. And I especially when it comes to advanced engineering, if you look at, I think we're mired with the belief that engineering is a dirty industry, it's a heavy industry, because people remember the coal industry, the heavy steel industries that used to abide and have smokestacks and everything else. Yeah. You know, those days are long gone, and we need to start promoting engineering as a viable and a flourishing profession. In the advanced engineering side of it, which is why I'm really keen to support the Advanced Engineering Show, if you bring a satellite or a rocket ship or an F1 car or the wingtip from a Eurofighter or from an Airbus A350 or whatever, kids are going to be inspired by that. And you know, once you've got them inspired at a youngish age, you know, when it comes to going into the secondary schools and taking their options, you kind of remember that. And you know, as I think people are going to hear when they speak, you know, when they hear the Richard Noble podcast, the golden era of engineering was really in the the middle 60s to middle 70s, when everyone wanted to be a rocket scientist. We had the moon landing going on, we had Concorde being developed, and everyone was really into engineering. And we've kind of let that slip. And honestly, that's the fault. If there is a fault, that's a fault of us older statesmen who really should have been taking care of our middle ground, if you like. I mean, I'm sure Ford are no different. We have our elder statesmen and we have people in their 30s and their 20s, and we kind of missed the middle demographic. There's a whole gap there that we kind of missed out. It's incumbent on us to fill that gap. If it's not going to be us who's going to do it, who do we expect to do it?
Absolutely. Now I can understand what you mean exactly, and I suppose as well, it was interesting that you said the 60s and 70s, when all those amazing things like Concorde were being designed and built and so on. And it also seems, certainly from the UK point of view, you know, the sort of Thatcher government with the early 80s, I don't know if attitudes as well, that was another catalyst for attitudes on the, you know, to sort of change a bit in terms of, you know, what, well, with the miners' strikes and things that happened there, and the sort of striving for money using sort of financial services perhaps was brought up more, which I'm not saying is a bad thing in itself, but I also think that sort of didn't help the PR of manufacturing and engineering, which seemed to go on the back burner, didn't it, really? I think you're right. I think what the youngsters may not be quite aware of, or I call them the youngsters, but people in general are perhaps not quite aware of, is how much exciting IP and innovation and knowledge is behind all this. As you say, I think it's like, oh, isn't that metal bashing, really, you know, which is far from it, really, and which is why the UK is still very much a forefront leader in is this high IP, high knowledge. As you say, the word is clues in the phrase advanced engineering, you know. So there's lots of jobs in software engineering, high-end design, artificial intelligence, you know, lots of kind of R&D that's coming over from some of our world-class universities. I mean, we've got at least two, maybe three of our universities are in the top 10 in the world. And there's lots going on there in terms of technology transfer and innovation. Do you think that we're, you know, that's another area through our through government relationships or catalyzing this through what's happening in universities? We try and do that with the show very much so, you know, to catalyze and bring together new spin outs and innovations that are going on at universities into industry on the show floor. Do you think that's another area we need to do more in?
Absolutely. We are in the UK, we are exceptionally good at hiding our light under a bushel. If we were in America, I'm not sure we'd have that trouble, which is not a criticism of our American colleagues by any means. They're just very good at how with all the great work they do. I struggle with it sometimes when I see some of the IP that comes out of the universities and even, you know, from heavy industry. I mean, I'm blessed. I'm going to use that word, and I absolutely mean it. We're working for an OEM, so I've worked all over the world. I've worked on many different projects, and you know, I've had a really, really good career at Ford. I've enjoyed every single minute. Yeah, so don't get me wrong. There's been the odd day, but
yes, of course.
By and large, you know, I would never have worked anywhere else. I really, really wouldn't.
Yeah.
And I've seen IP that I just think, wow, that's just incredible. How did you think of that? And as I said, from working with, especially in the area working now in advanced lightweight manufacturing and materials, working for an OEM, I get to see lots of innovation that comes through because, you know, let's be honest, everybody wants to work with the OEM. And, you know, rightly so. Eventually, you're going to have to get your IP or your product onto a finished vehicle or a finished aircraft or whatever.
Sure.
So I get to see a lot of innovation all the time. And some of the IP I see is just second to none. You know, so don't get me wrong, but sometimes I see things where I think that company that I saw a while ago is way more advanced with you on this. So, you know, I get to see both sides of the coin, if you like. But the amount of IP that I see coming through from UK universities and UK companies, absolutely world class. And
yeah.
I think we could just bring everybody together, which is, you know, where advanced engineering comes along, as you said, then honestly, there's no reason why the UK wouldn't rule the world, seriously. As I said, I've had the privilege of working all over the world on all kinds of different projects.
You must have seen some innovation, obviously, from other countries, and you still
absolutely
great. UK is right up there as one of the top sort of innovators in that regard. Yeah,
let me assure you, the UK is the leading innovator in these technologies, without a doubt. Every time I come back to the UK from working in a different area, I just think, wow,
that's really incredible.
The work is just exemplary. It really, really is.
Yeah. And what do you think we can do? Because you mentioned about shouting about it more, which is absolutely right. What do you think we can do that we're perhaps not doing so well at the moment in terms of that?
Yeah, I think I think we're a bit strung out, frankly. The way I kind of think of it, this seems a bit weird, but we've got the full six pack. What we lack is the plastic thing that holds everything together.
And yes,
if we could collaborate more, I don't have any doubt that, you know, if the universities would work more together, if we'd work with our SMEs and our tier ones and our OEMs would have way more collaboration, then I don't see any reason why we couldn't, you know, sort of rule the world. I mean, and I'm going to give you an example of this, and it is a bit of criticism of our government colleagues. I don't think it's been done deliberately, but it's something that we need to be aware of. So if you want to innovate in the and you want to do a collaboration project in automotive, then you get funding from the Advanced Propulsion Centre. If you want to do the same thing from an aerospace perspective, you've got the ATI, who can provide funding. But if you know we want to work on cross industry projects, and especially when it comes to sustainability, which I'm sure we're going to get onto later on. There's no reason why, when you're working on sustainability, automotive, construction, leisure, aviation, aerospace, space, they've all got the same problems. Everybody has exactly the same problem. It's not like aerospace have got a completely different problem to automotive. It's the same problem. And we can't work cross industry because the funding is set up in chimneys. Now, as I said, I don't think that's a deliberate thing, but trying to work on an automotive project that has aviation impacts, we found in the past that the funding hasn't been approved by APC because they say it should be an ATI funded project. And likewise, if you do it the other way around, ATI say it should be an APC funded project. And we've kind of got to get away from that. As I said, I don't think it's been done deliberately, but we need to be aware of it and we need to have plans in place to fix it, because especially when it comes to sustainability, everybody's got the same problem.
That's spot on, I think. Yeah. And obviously there are opportunities going on from a parallel sector that people don't know about in the other sector that could really catalyze things and get them going much, much faster. That things are being missed, aren't they, in that potentially? Well, I'm sure they are. Which is great, which is why we like to try and bring people. Well, we do bring people together from different sectors at the show. But they're always sort of saying that as well. It's like, I didn't realize that these guys were doing this, you know. I didn't realize I had to sort of look at this. This is something that serendipitously I came round an aisle and saw these guys that were showing this new material or this new application that I didn't realize existed. But it's difficult to do. To keep going, isn't it, all the time, and to have that in a systematic sort of forum is tricky, I suppose. But is that something that things like the HVM Catapult and Innovate UK try to do to bring together to an extent, I'm guessing. But
it certainly should be. I mean, because we have, like as you say, the HVM Catapult kind of own all of that funding, so they are the ones that put APC and ATI funding in place. It's actually Innovate UK that hold all of that cash and silo, if you know, I'm going to call it the word, I'm going to say silo because I can't think of a better word, silo the money kind of between the two. But you know, as you rightly said, we've got the Advanced Manufacturing Centre up in Sheffield, who are kind of aligned with Boeing. We've got the National Composite Centre that are kind of aligned with Airbus. We have the Manufacturing Technology Centre in Coventry, which is kind of aligned with Rolls-Royce. And you know, we've got all of these different organisations that I at Ford, I work with these guys all the time. So it's not like, you know, people don't understand that there's cross synergies between the industries. They absolutely do. Yeah. It's just how do we cross-link them when it comes to the funding and everything else. So we have the Ascend project, was, and honestly, I don't know which one it was funded by, but you know, that's got input from aviation as well as McLaren from an automotive perspective.
I think GKN have been involved in that.
Correct, absolutely. Yes,
because they've spoken about it at the show. Well, yeah,
right. You're right. So it is possible to do it, but it's really, really difficult. And yeah, I think. Potentially getting hold of the Innovate UK people to tell them, well, not, I'm sure they're aware, you know, we would just like to see plans in place to make life a lot easier if you want to do a cross-industry project. I think it's in our interest.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. We touched on sustainability and you've mentioned it a little bit, but I guess it's a word that's used a lot now. It is one of our themes probably our biggest watchword at this year's show, actually, in terms of probably presentation content and so on. But what's a bit of an open question, I suppose, but sustainability for you, what does it mean for you in terms of what your challenges are and what you're aiming to do?
Well, sustainability is all around net zero. You see some of the you saw some of the news articles last night, and I think the president or the chairman of the UN said that we're beyond global warming now, we're into global boiling.
Yes.
I thought that was a really good phrase, to be honest with you, and I think
very powerful.
Now, you know, I'm not an eco-warrior by any means. Anybody who knows me would not describe me as such. But honestly, I struggle internally in my own head as to how we haven't made more progress. I just don't understand. Really don't understand. We have sustainable fuel. It's a thing. Yes. It's real. Why aren't we mass producing it? Why do we not have plants that are just churning it out by the millions of litres every day?
Yeah.
Just don't understand. I remember, I mean, I'm of an age where I remember when we brought in unleaded fuel, and everybody going up in arms about, well, my car can't run on unleaded fuel and you can't buy it anywhere. There's only one in three, or there's only one in like 100 petrol stations in London that carries it. How am I going to get fuel? And it seemed like within a week, it was everywhere.
We managed.
It was the only thing you could buy. And I just think, if you know, where we have the means, it's been invented, we have the opportunity, we have the requirement, more importantly, why aren't we on sustainable fuels? I understand that they're not completely carbon neutral. I don't want to get any letters saying that that's not net zero. I completely get it. It isn't net zero. We still produce hydrocarbons when we burn it. But I don't understand it too much, but from what I understand of the science, it puts out the same CO2 that went in to make it. So it's kind of, you could argue that it's net zero carbon.
Neutral, yeah.
Okay, it might not be perfect, but it's a million times better than what we have right now.
Yeah.
Already been invented. And if this, you know, and you could use it as a stepping stone immediately. And yes, you could argue that it's going to be more expensive, but is it really? It's more expensive now, no doubt about it, when you're making such low volumes of it. No one's going to ever going to convince me that inventing an oil rig, towing it out into the middle of the ocean, drilling down 8 miles, pumping a load of crap out of the ocean bed, putting it onto tankers, sending it to a refinery where you turn it into 10 different materials, then put it on a truck, send it to a petrol station, that it can't be any cheaper than doing all of that. It's crop based. Why?
Yeah.
And no one's ever going to convince me that it's going to be more expensive to do that than it is to use oil.
Yeah. Well, this is a specific thing as well that we'll be touching on, I think, in the Aero Engineering Forum at this year's show at the NEC. We've got, for instance, the chief engineer at Rolls-Royce UltraFan engine, which you may be aware they're testing at the moment, which is their 100% sustainable aviation fuel engine, real drop-in stuff, you know, So there's a lot of stuff happening there in terms of testing, I think, in terms of what Rolls-Royce are trying to do. But as you say, you know, sustainable aviation fuel, for instance, is what, 7 times more expensive than the current kerosene. And one reason being apparently that I think there's a feeling that there's not enough investment in producing it at more volume, and obviously producing it more volume can drive the cost down for its use. And there's an argument that, you know, potential investors are saying, well, in 20 years time, is this going to be a good investment for me? Because you're talking about using hydrogen. But of course, we need something. Hydrogen's great. And it, you know, there's still an argument in terms of how that will work and the infrastructure and how you're going to create it. Those hurdles you're going to, you know, they're going to take 20 years to get over. And there's a lot of lot of argument about that, you know, or heated debate, shall I say. But we've got to do the SAF in the meantime. And I'm sure, like most things in life, there's no one fixed bullet. And in the future, there'll be hydrogen, perhaps, and sustainable fuels that we used as alternatives, you know. So we have to use SAF or invest in sustainable fuels, don't we? And there seems to be a little bit of a reticence. And I wonder in some cases if it's because of that. They think it's some sort of, potential investors think it's a sort of stopgap thing that hasn't got a longer shelf life. I don't know, but that's what I've heard. But we definitely need to do that. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, the bit I don't completely understand. I'm sure there's a million reasons behind it, most of them business related. Companies aren't getting involved with it more, frankly. I think you're right. When it comes to hydrogen, I mean, everyone seems to be holding out for the end game. But the end game could take us 25, 30 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the meantime, what are we going to do? Just continue to burn oil until we can manufacture green hydrogen in the amount of quantities that we need that's going to satisfy the entire planet to be net zero. We can't wait that long. I mean, I think it was at Advanced Engineering last year, actually. There was a couple of guys from the freight industry who were on a panel discussion. And they kept saying, you know, why can't we burn hydrogen? People keep saying that we can't burn hydrogen because it puts out hydrocarbons. It's not completely net zero, but it's 99% net zero. We just can't do that last bit, but we can burn it, and we can burn that tomorrow afternoon. Why aren't we doing the interim step while we're waiting for the final step? And I think they're absolutely right. I think Sebastian Vettel, the F1 driver, I mean, he's hugely into sustainability these days, which is one of the reasons why he quit F1. He drove an ex-Nigel Mansell Williams up the hill at Goodwood recently at the last Festival of Speed. Yeah. And he was just gobsmacked as why F1 is waiting for 2026 to be on sustainable fuels. He drove his car up the hill with sustainable fuel in his 1992 Williams. He said it's been available for years. Why are they waiting until 2026? He doesn't understand. And I don't understand either. Someone's going to have to explain it to me because I just don't get it.
It's fascinating, that is. I mean, are there any other places in the world that are you know, a lot down the line on this with sustainable fuel in terms of its production, do you know?
Not that I'm aware of, to be honest with you. I think making sustainable hydrogen is probably more advanced in potentially some of the Nordic countries where they've got a lot of green hydrogen a lot more efficiently than we can. But honestly, I don't know the answer to that. And you know, we can't ignore the fact that we in the more developed world, if you like, we've understood the problem for a while now, and we are telling the rest of the developing world that no, you've got to stop burning oil. You can't do that anymore. And you know, you can understand their point of view as well. You've been doing it for 30 years. What do you mean for 100 years? What do you mean we can't burn fuel? It's the only option we have. And we said, well, no, you can't. You have to stop. We have the responsibility to work it out.
Yes.
We are the ones that started it. We are the ones that recognise the issue. We are the ones with the answers. It's our responsibility to make sure that everybody can do this without suffering economically. And as I said many times, the economics are going to dictate this. There is no question about it. If people lose money on it, they're not going to do it. So the economics are everything on this. But honestly, I don't understand why the oil producers aren't being more involved with sustainable fuels. If, you know, the people that are going to be out of a job in the next 30 years are going to be the oil companies. So they've got to replace something. And if it's not going to be hydrogen, why isn't it going to be sustainable fuels? They're the ones who are going to lose everything.
Exactly. And that and it makes sense in a way if they were more involved, because they have the infrastructure there as well, don't they? So it should be them, really, who are investing in that sort of technology. It's interesting. I don't know what the answer is to that, but in terms of also sustainability, in your more specific aims at Ford, for instance, and lightweighting and use of materials, what are you looking for there, or what pressures are you under in terms of having to source the material, the raw material, where it's come from and how recyclable it will be in 20 years time, or at the end of life? Are these big issues from your day job point of view, sort of thing?
Yeah, they're huge issues. So our chairman Bill Ford, who has his name on the buildings, he's very, very hot on sustainability, and that kind of seeps through from the top. We have a sustainability engineering department whose job it is to actually work this stuff out to make sure that that there's no carbon leakage. We aim to be carbon neutral by 2050, but that I think every other sort of manufacturer is in the same position.
Yeah.
We are starting to look at our supply chain now with regard to embedded carbon. There's very little point in, for instance, saying that we're going to be low carbon, that we're going to be a low carbon company or a carbon neutral company if all we're going to do is source all of our components from a country that doesn't quite have the same embedded carbon sort of priorities as we do, for instance. We've just passed that on. And we've got a whole department who are starting to look at now what are the carbon accounting measures that our sub-suppliers use and our tier ones use, and how do they meet the Ford requirements. Obviously, that's going to be a developing thing. We, as much as we would probably love to do it immediately, it's an unviable thing to do. Back to that business equation again. And it's, it probably isn't the right thing to do at the moment either. But certainly, we are ramping that up year by year. When it comes to lightweighting and my role specifically, I'm very keen that we start to look at more composite materials in our vehicles, not necessarily carbon. Carbon's expensive, we understand that. But there's nothing wrong with glass for the majority of the parts that we would use. There's nothing wrong with glass. I'm doing a couple of Innovate UK projects now on glass, and they're kind of bearing some fruit now. I can't go into
that's interesting.
Details, unfortunately, but we're starting to see some really good results from them. And glass and carbon have a couple of really good side effects. So not only are they lighter, therefore they're more the vehicle would be more sustainable, but you can make, for instance, and anecdotally, from the year 2000 on the front of a Transit van, we used to have the grille opening panel, so the slam panel that the grille, that the bonnet slams down on. That used to be 17 parts welded together and out steel. And we replaced that with a one-piece moulding. And there's no reason why you can't do that for quite a lot of the components, to be perfectly honest with you. It would work. What it needs is the due diligence in making sure that the materials are all good, that they pass crash regulations and everything else. But more importantly, what do we do with them at end of life? The automotive industry is the only one with an end of life vehicle directive. And that's a good thing, frankly, but it's also a hindrance, because until we completely understand what we do with the materials and how we recycle them, how we disassemble the world, you have to do this in order. Can you reuse them? If you can't reuse them, can you disassemble them? Once you've disassembled them, can you recycle them? And then can you put them back into the circular economy? Glass is very difficult because glass is so cheap to make it from virgin material that you kind of start to question, why would you use glass as a recycled material when you can buy it so cheap as a virgin material? So, and I think, our colleagues in the windblade industry are starting to see that now. You see some of the horrific pictures of some of the buried wind blades in fields, because no one knows what to do with them on the decommissioned wind blades. What do you do with them? There's inherent value in carbon, but there's not a lot of inherent value in glass, so people aren't recycling them, because what do you do with them? So we kind of solved one problem on green energy, but we've created an environmental problem with what do we do with all these old wind blades. One of the projects I have with Innovate UK is to address exactly that, and Composites UK have a project working on exactly that. So there is hope that we will try and understand what the business equation is to to recycle glass, because unless there's a unless there's a business equation to recycle glass, nobody's going to do it. We have two reasons that we do things in industry. One is we make money out of it, and the other one is we're legislated to do it. And there's no legislation at the moment, so we've either got to find a business case for it, or someone needs to tell us you can't recycle, you can't use glass because you can't recycle it. And if you do recycle it, then you need to have a certain amount of recycler in your new component, or it needs to be 100% recycler or whatever. But there must be a second use for it. And the way I've kind of used my role within Composites UK and Ford actually is to try and figure out, we need to do these things in parallel. If I want the vehicle to be lighter and we want to use lighter materials, then we have to work out the recycling equation at the same time. The aerospace industry, they've got 35 years until that plane's sort of decommissioned. They don't have to worry about 35 years. The boat industry, I've always looked at them with very green eyes because they've been using sort of glass fiber for the last 60, 70 years. And they don't have an end of life vehicle directive. There's no registration document for a boat. Anybody could claim they own a boat, from what I understand. And at the end of life, you know, when it's completely like worthless and you can't do anything with it, it's kind of left to rot in a marina somewhere, or
you see that
out to the middle of the sea and a hole drilled in it, and they let it sink, which is not environmentally friendly, but it's what happens. So, you know, the boat industry is starting to wake up and smell the coffee and realize that they have to work on this problem before they're legislated to do it as well. So we have a whole industry slowly realizing that, oh yeah, these composite materials, we've got to do something about. Now, fortunately, there are some really good methods to recover recycled fibrous materials, where you can also recover the resins, not just thermoset resins, sorry, not just thermoplastic resins, but also thermoset resins, where you can recover 100% of the material. So you get the resin and the fiber. In fact, I'm working on a British standard right now with a company called B&M Longworth in the north of England, who invented a recovery process that uses steam. I've used it a couple of times on projects that I've had before, and it's just fantastic. They've had their work independently verified by the National Composite Centre and by Boeing, and whereby they put a piece of carbon fibre, a used section of aircraft, if you like, through their process. They've managed to get the fibre and the resin out of it, and the fibre has exactly the same mechanical properties as the fibre that went in it. So unlike pyrolysis or solvolysis, where you damage the fibre, this doesn't interact with the fibre in any way. All it does is effectively clean it. So you're able to recover the fibre, and it's got the same mechanical properties as when in it.
That's fantastic.
And honestly, I've used it a couple of times on projects, and it's.
And is it there? Is it B&M Longworth? I have some familiarity with them because they've exhibited at Advanced Engineering. They might be doing that this year as well. Is that their own sort of discovery, invention, that process, as a matter of interest?
It is indeed.
Okay.
And it's actually a really good story, the way it was invented. So I hope I'm not giving any secrets away, but it was actually quite funny when the story was told to me. So the owner of this guy called John Norris, really, really nice guy, does not stop inventing things. He's just incredible. He was walking through his factory once, and they were cleaning an industrial filter, and he thought the machine was off. So he opened the door and just heard a thud and thought, oh, what have I done? Went to see his technical team and said, I've just opened this door and I didn't realise the machine was running. And they all went, probably ruined the £200,000 filter, so we're going to have to replace that. And when they looked at it, the filter was pristine, absolutely immaculate. And they didn't completely understand why. And it was only when they did the due diligence of what happened, they discovered it was the decompression cycle of him opening the door that got rid of all of the dirt and the coagulants, if you like, in the filter, and brought them out. So they've been using steam under pressure to try and do it, but it's actually the decompression cycle that got all the dirt off. And then they had a professor from a university come and visit them one day and said, you know, you're missing a trick there, because if it works on dirt, it will work on anything. You could probably strip resin off of the fiber. You could use it to clean anything. So they put a piece of carbon fiber through, and it recovered the fiber. And because it's not physically interacting with the fibre, it's just cleaning it, the fibre looked immaculate. So they sent it off to Boeing and NCC and said, yep, absolutely spot on. So amazing process, completely by accident. And so the, obviously they wrote the IP, which they own. It's a global IP, and it's just amazing. And as I said, I've used that process, which we are calling pressolysis. We're actually writing a British standard on that to get it included, because at the moment it's kind of classed madly as solvolysis because they use water. H2O is a formula, ergo must be a solvent. Even though it's steam and it's water, because it's got a chemical formula, it's classed as solvolysis. Doesn't make any sense. So if you were looking for a sustainable process, you can't find one. Hence, we're trying to write it so that it's exactly the right thing to do. But yeah, I mean, and don't get me wrong, there are places where solvolysis and pyrolysis will probably be the correct process that you want to recover your fibre. But it's not the, you know, they're not the be all and end all. You don't have to put old fibre in concrete, for instance. You could use it as fibre sort of going into the next product, if you like. There are going to be uses for it, whether that's old aircraft going into automotive then going into leisure. You know, you might not be might not be able to use a car part that you recover into the same car part, because you know you're going to have different lengths of fiber that you might have to chop up, which you know you can't use in the same component again. But there's no reason why you probably couldn't make a tennis racket, for instance, or a bike frame, or or something like that. And then you can use it for the medical industry, for prosthetics. And then at the end of its life, when it's got physically no more uses, then you could potentially put it into concrete, if you like. So you've got this massive food chain that can go all the way from the very, very top of the material chain all the way down. And that could take 100 years. So it's in the food chain for like years and years and years, which is really what we're after.
Yeah. To what extent do you think that's happening at the moment? Are there any examples where that is really happening much?
Not a great deal so glass fiber is finding its way into concrete to try and replace rebar. We understand that, and USEA, who are the European equivalents of Composites UK, they're the European Composites Industry Association, they're working with us in Composites UK to try and get that worked out, because at the moment everything's kind of going into cement kilns, which, you know, it's not a bad thing, but it's probably not its optimal usage. So we're trying to work out where those gaps are. I mean, anecdotally, I've used this before, this is anecdotally, I don't want any letters. Approximately 5 tons of carbon fiber are scrapped for every A350 or Boeing 787 that are manufactured. 5 tons of carbon fiber, really high-end material, because it's going in aviation. And when I say scrap, you need to understand what that means. Okay, so in the aircraft industry, they mainly will probably wholly use prepreg materials, and you can't put prepreg materials in the ground without curing them first, because it's poisonous and it will poison the water table and the soil. So you have to cure it before you can grind it up to put it into the ground. So they take 5 tons of perfectly good material every year, albeit they're offcuts. They put it in their autoclave so they can cure it. Then they send it to someone who grinds it up, or they do it themselves. Then they put it into the ground, and it's around, what, at the moment, £150 per ton to put anything into the ground these days. So we worked out that all of that curing, grinding, putting it into the ground process probably costs Airbus around €500 per ton to go and do that. Or they could get that offcut of material, put it back in the freezer so it doesn't go off, and give that to a company who's got use for it, whether it's in the leisure industry, even the automotive industry, who knows. But someone should be able to use that very, very high-end material that's going to be ground up and go into the ground if we don't do anything with it. So they could put all of that in the back of a truck with a check for €200. So someone gets free material and a check for €200, and they're €300 a ton better off.
Yeah.
And someone gets free material that clearly we understand that's not going to happen. They're going to want to sell it on. I'm being facetious with that. But it just goes to show that there's opportunities there to bring the food chain all together, if you like.
Yeah.
What we lack, as I said before, is the ability to bring everything together.
The joined up thinking. Yeah.
Absolutely. If we could just, you know, think laterally and think, okay, if we know that this company's got a load of, and I'm going to call it scrap, but it isn't scrap. It's never been used. It's brand new. It's just remnants, if you like. In the carpet industry, they would call that a remnant and they'd sell it to you in the carpet shop. But in the carbon fiber industry, that's called scrap.
And I suppose that's one thing that something like additive manufacturing might mitigate a bit in terms of, because I suppose what you're talking about is sort of subtractive manufacturing where, you know, you're cutting something that you want, that you're creating the part, and then what's left over is waste, for instance. How much do you think processes like additive manufacturing might help to mitigate that, or is that, you know, in volume a bit too much of an expensive method, or is it being used more and more?
The technology is moving on every day. I get pitched quite a lot of additive manufacturing stuff, and the Manufacturing Technology Centre looks like it's going to be the catapult centre for additive manufacturing. They're doing a lot of work. I've been trying to get up there for a while to go and see. Again, it's been a while since I've been up there. Additive manufacturing from a volume OEM perspective, like Ford, not the easiest thing. The volumes are so low and the costs are so high. But having said that, you know, we work, and I'm more of a commercial vehicle guy than I'm a car guy. And we have requirements from our fleet vehicles, for instance, where they want specific components for specific applications for their job. So, for instance, British Gas, when they buy 5,000 vehicles or 10,000 vehicles a year, will have requirements for their vehicle that the post office don't need, for instance. And for every part that they need us to go and make for them, that's a part we have to tool up and then put on the side of the line. And just to put that into perspective, the current Transit has, I think, 8 wheelbases, 4 roof heights, God knows how many engine and gearbox combinations. So excluding colour and trim, our plant could work for about a year and a half and not make the same vehicle twice. And we make about 350,000 vehicles a year. So it's just crazy. So every time we want to put a requirement into the vehicle to suit a specific manufacturer, that's really difficult because, as I said, we have to tool that up. And then we have to put that part on the side of the line. And there's only so much space we have in our line to store all of these parts.
Yeah.
So additive manufacturing for those niche customers could be the way forward, depending on the complexity of the parts. You'd have, like there's no tooling involved, for instance. You're just effectively 3D printing what you want. So there's no reason why you couldn't have a 3D printed metal wall composite part, including carbon fiber. That, you know, you can make, say, 10,000 parts a year, as long as they're relatively small parts, and you can just leave the machine going all day and all night, and, you know, then you've got your bespoke niche part that you need for this specific supply.
Yes.
I think at the moment, 3D printing, if you can convince the safety boards in aerospace, it's probably got more of an aerospace application than automotive, but for mainstream automotive, for volume OEMs rather. Potentially people like Lotus, McLaren,
that
might be more viable for them than it probably would be for a Ford or an Opel or a Mercedes or an Audi.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I thought. OK. Yeah. Makes sense. OK. Well, we've been chatting for best part of an hour, actually, which is great. So it was sort of coming up to our usual kind of time on these editions. But before I sort of start to draw to a close, any final thoughts, Alan, from what we've been talking about in terms of what you want to leave people with, you know?
You know what? I have. I'm going to potentially get on a soapbox now, so you need to tell me when to shut up. I was thinking about this last night and about this specific podcast and about, you know, what is it I want to get across. And one of the things that I find particularly frustrating is that when things start to, you know, when you start to question, well, why hasn't this been done yet? And why aren't we doing that? So the conversation we had on biofuels, for instance, why aren't we already more advanced on that? It doesn't make any sense. The first people we tend to blame are our policymakers. I don't think that's correct, frankly. It is correct. They are the people in government. They are the ones that set the policy. But we kind of, and I don't know if this is fueled by the media, and I think it is, honestly. We tend to go, government, what have they ever done for us? Frankly, I don't agree with that argument. What we need to bear in mind is that, I mean, the population of Britain, what's the voting population? 35 million, maybe?
Yeah.
We've got 650 MPs. Only half of them are in power in any one time, just over half in power at any one time. Sure. Of those, only, 12 have a position of power? So what we're effectively saying is that these 35 million people think that we're being governed by these 12 people. What I would like to leave you with is a little thought. You know, they work for us, right? It's not the other way around. They have a job because of us. So if we don't like their policies, or we want it changed, or we want them to have a specific policy, that's down to us. We have a voice. We don't just have to accept everything that they say.
Yeah.
We are the electorate. They represent us. This is a democracy. Democracy is they represent their electorate. It's not we don't do what they say. They do what we want them to do. That's the whole point. They represent the people. They're for the people. They're with the people and for the people. So as a electorate, when we see this stuff happening, it's as much to do with us. We bear that responsibility as much as our decision makers. And if we don't agree with it, you know what? We have the power of the vote, which is really powerful. And if we saw it at the last by-election in Uxbridge.
In Uxbridge, yes.
We're very, very unhappy about the ULEZ thing. And don't get me onto that. But people were very unhappy about the ULEZ thing. And they voted Tory, where no one was expecting that to happen, because they were so upset with the ULEZ thing going out to their borough. That's exactly the right thing. If you don't agree with the policy, you have the right to change it. You have the vote. So we've got to stop pointing the finger at these 12 people that we think are the people that we believe are keeping them down. And we've got to think, well, hang on a minute. They work for us. We need to do something about it. And I just think these 35 million people, we have a voice. Let's use it.
A great final note to end on. Yes, couldn't agree more.
I told you I was going to get a soapbox.
Well, Alan, that was great. Thanks so much for your time and those insights. Great conversation, I think.
Pleasure.
That was lovely. Alan Banks, Dr. Alan Banks, UK Lightweight Innovations Manager at Ford Motor Company and Chair of the Board of Directors for Composites UK. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks very much.